Education and Training. Excerpts from A Brief History of the Education of the Blind and Visually Impaired in Trinidad and Tobago by Maurice Connor, 2000/2001, reproduced. Foreword. Some people may feel that the changes and improvements in the education of the blind and visually impaired have not come rapidly enough during the 86-year existence of organized welfare work for the blind in this country. After 11 years as a student at the Institute for the Blind and 34 years on the staff of the School for Blind Children, Santa Cruz, I can understand these feelings. Much time is lost before the emphasis is shifted from merely providing the fish to teaching someone how to fish. There must be a more proactive approach to the education of the blind and visually impaired that will allow many of them to become independent, productive citizens of the community. Education is an ever-changing process, and I cherish the hope that someone will find it worthwhile to improve upon this booklet, recording those changes and achievements that are beneficial to the visually challenged. I also cherish very pleasant memories of my brief term as principal of the school with its mix of the rough and the smooth. My sincere thanks to all the staff for their loyalty and support during that period, Miss Agatha Millington, the chief house mother, and Miss Carol Moore, the clerk typist. Mrs. Rosalind McNamara, dictation and friend, has contributed greatly to the production of this booklet, leafing through the old newspapers in the archives, providing some background for the beginning of the first period. Written material on this entire subject is very scant. A great deal is based on my own experience and the oral tradition and Mr. Francis Khan, who was responsible for the computer production. First period. Mr. James Augustus Alves landed in this country and became one of the leading pioneers in welfare work for the blind. His arrival marked the dawn of a new era not only for the blind of Trinidad and Tobago, but also for the Eastern Caribbean and Guyana. The Institute for the Blind, as it was then called, opened its doors on May 18, 1914. In those early days, the curriculum consisted of the teaching of reading in Braille and Moon type, Braille writing, handicraft and bed making. Moon type was a system of embossed letters which closely resembled print. It was invented by Dr. William Moon for those whose fingers were not sufficiently sensitive to cope with a Braille. Very few people learned to read. Moon and Braille became the only form of reading and writing taught throughout the school. During the morning sessions from 9 to 11, reading and writing were taught. In the afternoon sessions between 1 and 3, the accent was on handicraft and bed making. Basket making was the main form of handicraft at that time. Miss Christabel Saunston became Mr. Alves' assistant, and was responsible for the teaching of needlework to the women, with help from Miss Lucia Williams, the first matron to be appointed to the institute. Miss Williams was given two rooms at the back of the premises. In later years, more spacious quarters were provided upstairs in the main building overlooking Duke and Edward Streets. Mr. Alves had the onerous task of preparing much of the reading material by hand. As time went on, however, the curriculum did expand, and by 1936, the year in which I arrived in Trinidad, reading, writing, arithmetic, history and geography, piano and the rudiments of typing all formed the scholastic program. Basket making was still the main form of handicraft, with chair caning running a close second. There was also some mat making, which was done on a small scale, according to orders received. A Braille examination was held 1 year after the institute was opened, but this was discontinued for some unclear reason. During my time, any attempt to introduce examinations was firmly resisted by some of the administrators. There must have been some kind of assessment, for an annual prize-giving function was held at the Royal Victoria Institute around Christmas time during my early years as a student. The most outstanding achiever of that early period was Joe Purty. He was discovered among the adults at the House of Refuge, now the St. James Medical Complex, and was brought to the Institute in 1923 at the tender age of 4. He was a good student and an excellent pianist. Joe was, in fact, the first blind student to sit an external exam in piano, under the guidance of Mr. Donald Greaves, a leading musician and choir master of the day. When Mr. Alves retired, Joe was appointed headmaster and held that position for a number of years until his appointment as field secretary in the Blind Welfare Association, which was incorporated by an act of the legislature in 1947. Like most elementary schools, we've received all our reading material from England. Much of it was interesting and in many instances, formed a good introduction to literature. The only local book which I can still recall was The Little Folks, from which we learned some geography of our country. An interesting subject which was done every Wednesday afternoon was general knowledge. Each student was required to prepare 10 questions for answers and be the quiz master for that day. Though many of the questions were far-fetched, we learned a great deal about our country, especially Port of Spain. We learned what streets bounded certain prominent buildings, such as the Red House and the Queen's Park Oval, as well as the names of some of the streets which crossed main traffic throughout. I can certainly say that this knowledge was quite useful to me when my turn came to leave the institute and I had to get around the city under my own steam, so to speak. Another informative feature of our scholastic life in those days was the visits by students from schools across the city. I can recall many an exciting mental arithmetic competition. We didn't often win, but they were nevertheless stimulating. In the month of December, some of the adults and children, encouraged and assisted by Mrs. Layla Gordon Smith, a member of the Institute's committee, would prepare a concert which was performed at the House of Refuge. I remember quite vividly playing Torno Sorrentuno one key from my first performance on the flute. There was a little touch of drama on one occasion when Mrs. Thomas, the teacher in charge of the ladies, wrote a play entitled Politeness Pays Best. Some of the adults displayed their talent at the annual treat sponsored by the Coterie of Social Workers or Optimist Club, reciting one of their favorite poems or rendering a popular song of the day. During my years as a student, there were 6 to 8 children in residence at any one time. The girls and younger boys occupied the upstairs dormitory, while the older boys lived in the one downstairs. There were 6 members of staff, a matron, who was responsible to the board for the entire operation of the institute, a nursemaid who looked after the children, a maid to look after the matron's needs and quarters and assist with the children, a cook, a washer and a porter. When Mrs. Enos Nelson was appointed matron in 1938, rules were relaxed and we enjoyed a greater run of the place, after school and on weekends a guitar, quattro, cello and flute and made them available to the students. As a result, we formed a small ensemble which came together to practice on Saturday afternoons. We were also allowed more freedom to use the piano. On afternoons during the week we would go for walks to Victoria Square and many children came to chat with us. That's where I first met Monica Ortiz, who later became one of the Life in Residence country's leading sopranos. Sometimes we would go to other parks such as Woodford Square, Lord Harris Square or the Memorial Park. Victoria Square was the most popular one, perhaps because it was the nearest to the institute. On Sunday afternoons we strolled downtown by the stores, as we used to say. The religious needs of the children were also looked after. On Sunday mornings the Roman Catholics attended 6.30 Mass at Sacred Heart Church, while the rest went to the mid-morning service at Trinity Cathedral. There was also a general service for all, which was held in a classroom every Tuesday morning. This was conducted by some members of the Trinity Deanery. Dean Holt visited regularly. On Wednesday mornings a nun came to give religious instructions to the RCs. Morning and night prayers were mandatory for the younger children and these were supervised and taught by some of the senior girls. Mrs. Enos Nelson was the last matron to be appointed. During her term of office there was a marked improvement in the freedom and social life of the children in residence. She also made significant improvements in the general business of the institute. As the years went by, the administrators became less rigid in their approach to the work and so the students were able to enjoy a greater degree of socialization. Joe Purty would often bring some of the singers to rehearse at the institute and I can even recall going to the radio distribution, which was later known as the Rediffusion Network, as part of the ensemble to play on one of the programs. I was also allowed to audition for one of Auntie Kay's early talent shows on radio. Some of the girls from nearby Tranquility School used to visit us on afternoons and we enjoyed some happy friendships with them. During Mr. Arthur Roberts' term as superintendent, The Nelsonian players rehearsed quite often at the Institute and I would sometimes be asked to provide background music for a scene. The young people were quite friendly and I really enjoyed doing it. In the late 1930s during the Christmas season, we had visits from philanthropic groups who came with generous gifts. Each year children from Miss Ritchie's school gave a most entertaining concert. Another group which came regularly during the Christmas season was Bert McLean and some members of his jazz band. He played current songs and calypsos and everyone, children, adults and staff, enjoyed themselves immensely partaking of the refreshments and tripping the light fantastic, but the advent of the Second World War put a damper on these activities. Our sports and recreation were not very organized. We did have a try at some tug of war and our own modified version of cricket. I can remember doing some arm and leg exercises or drill as it was called to instructions and recorded music which were played on the popular wind-up gramophone. The most popular game among the men and boys was dominoes. We didn't put the dominoes in formation. They were simply pushed into the center of the table and we made mental notes of the matching ends. This made the rounds go much faster and there was great excitement when someone made a mistake or blocked a game. There were times too, when the porter would take some of the older boys for an early morning walk around the savannah, but these were infrequent. At the age of 18 most of the boys went to the Saunston Memorial Home, which was located on Cipriani Boulevard at that time. The girls moved over to the St. Mary's Home for Blind Women on Fraser Street, which was run by the Coterie of Social Workers. These young adults continued to attend the Institute either working at one of the crafts in the workshop or as monitors in the classroom. The older adults who came to the Institute did very good work and were generally content with their lot. For some of the young people who changed residence, however, life took a different turn. Welfare work for the blind during that early period was extremely custodial. When a person entered the Institute it became his/her world, so to speak. Very little thought, if any, was given to preparing the students for the world outside. Consequently, when a student left the shelter of the Institute with a more than satisfactory elementary education, and, having certain expectations, there was keen disappointment and frustration when these ambitions could not be realized. Some people sent for correspondence courses but these soon petered out, for one reason or another. Others sought escape in alcohol. There were, indeed, many discussions among some of the young people who became very cynical and bitter at the failure of some social encounter. There were some, on the other hand, who, in spite of the severe disadvantages, led useful lives, got married and raised families. Around the mid-40s, there were signs that a wind of change was beginning to blow. The committee of the day invited Colonel E. A. Baker, managing director of the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, CNIB, to come to Trinidad, conduct a survey and submit a report. The transfer of responsibility for the Institute from the Board of Industrial Training to the newly formed association marked the end of the first period of welfare work for the blind in Trinidad and Tobago and the beginning of a new era. Top Left, 2001. Youth in Education Leaders Award, TOP Right, 2001. Newspaper article. Mikkel Terrestrial Succeeds, Bottom Left, 2001. Newspaper article. Alicia Lalite Succeeds. Second period. A different outlook is reflected in the opening paragraph of the ordinance, which states that the association is responsible for full training, education and placement of blind persons. One of the most important steps taken by the association during its early years was the separation of school from the workshop. The building at the corner of Duke and Edward Streets became a commercial center and also housed the head offices of the association. The new school, situated in the Santa Cruz Valley, opened its doors in January, 1952. The children at Duke Street were moved to the new school and within a short period of time the student population began to increase. Admission of students from islands in the Eastern Caribbean and Guyana started in 1953, with the advent of the new school. There came a completely new approach to the education of blind and visually impaired children. Attempts were made to place children in classes according to age or ability, regular testing was done and end-of-term examinations were introduced. Some new subjects were added to the timetable: gardening and woodwork for the boys and domestic science, home economics, for the girls. Every effort was made to follow the national curriculum and more local textbooks were introduced. It was decided to introduce the primary school leaving certificate examination. The Ministry of Education was quite receptive to the idea, and around 1980 to 1981 a number of students wrote that examination for the first time. It was indeed a great incentive to the students. Though the new school was still classified as primary, it soon became clear to the staff that some students were capable of going well beyond that stage. Thus it was that in 1958 arrangements were made to send the first student abroad for specialized training in stenography and related subjects. Francis Kahn spent approximately 1 year at the Training College of the Royal National Institute for the Blind at Pembridge Place, London, a centre for young adults. He passed all the examinations set by the Royal Society of Arts. His success also marked the breakthrough into open employment for the blind and visually impaired in this country. Some years later, Ramesh Ramnath Singh, another student, was sent to the same college in London to study stenography. On his return, he worked in the public service for a period of time. Still a little later on, Cecilia Ramsawak Singh, one of our first students to write the GCEO level examinations, worked with the Ministry of Education for some time after returning from England, where she took a secretarial course. One of our overseas students from Antigua, Ivor Ford, attended the Royal Normal College, now known as the National College for the Blind, and studied stenography. When he returned to Antigua, he worked with the Supreme Court for a while but is now doing valuable work with the Ministry of Youth in that island. Another Antiguan, Aubrey Webson, has done very good work on behalf of the blind at international level. He was the first executive director of the Caribbean Council for the Blind to be appointed from the Caribbean, and then worked for a while with Helen Keller International, after which his services were sought by Hilton Perkins, a US-based non-governmental organization which gives technical assistance to developing countries undertaking projects for the visually impaired, where he is now in charge of Caribbean and African affairs. The teaching of music, especially piano, has been a part of the school's curriculum for many years. It has been, and still is, one skill which enables a blind person to become more independent and self-reliant. A number of students have taken the practical examinations of the Royal Schools, with most outstanding among them being Michael Need, a native of Guyana, came in 1959 at the age of 10. He too was sent to England initially to study stenography. Fortunately for him, he was able to switch to music and went on to obtain his LRAM. Although the piano remained the chief instrument for the teaching of music, efforts were made to introduce other instruments. In the late 50s, one of the leading oil companies donated a set of pans and our first steel band was formed. It was given the happy title of the Merrymakers School Orchestra. With the departure of the students around 1963, interest in the steel band lapsed. There was, however, a revival during the 1970s. We enjoyed the services of Mr. Fitzroy and Issa's tutor. One girl, Shirley Duall Canty, entered one of the national pan festivals and gave a creditable solo performance. The guitar was another popular instrument among the students. Mrs. Connie Julian, an American who lived here for some years, started the class and also purchased some very good guitars for the school. Before her departure, she asked Patrick Gavia, one of the country's well-known guitarists, to take over the class. David Matthews was one of the few students who went on to provide some entertainment at his family's business place. Also, Alison Nelson, a graduate of St. Dominic's Convent who has performed at concerts and tea parties, singing and accompanying herself on the instrument. Both boys and girls enjoyed learning to play the recorder, for it was a relatively simple instrument to handle and it gave them a sense of achievement when they learned to play simple tunes fairly quickly. We have had some successful performances at concerts with trios and soloists, and one boy from Tobago, Colin Roberts, entered the National Music Festival. He gave quite a good account of himself, scoring a mark of 84. The contribution of Mrs. Rita Knox to the musical life of the school cannot be overlooked. As wife of the first resident principal, Mr. John Knox, she occupied the post of house mother for several years. Her knowledge of the piano and keen interest in singing were of enormous benefit to the students, particularly the girls. She taught them some beautiful duets and vocal solos. It was due to her coaching that Yvonne Bennett, a student with a lovely soprano voice, was able to enjoy some success in one of the national music festivals. It was also due to her efforts that the Christmas concerts were such outstanding successes during the late 50s and early 60s. Handicraft, the extent to which handicraft has been taught has been a subject of much debate among members of staff. Plasticine and paper folding, origami, are always useful tools with which to develop the manual skills among the infants and juniors. In upper classes, knitting was introduced from time to time, depending on the knowledge and initiative of the teachers. Mrs. Rita Knox carried on a craft class after lunch for several years, teaching rug weaving and simple sewing to the girls. Under Mr. Fitzgerald Blackman's tuition, some of the senior boys learned the traditional crafts of basketry and chair caning. They were therefore able to hold their own when the time came for them to leave school and attend one of the workshops. The crowded curriculum of the primary school has always limited the amount of time available for craft. Appointment and training of teachers. In the early days of the new school's existence, teachers were appointed either directly by the association or through secondment from the regular teaching service. It has also been made mandatory that any applicant for a teaching position must be a qualified teacher of the country or possess qualifications equivalent thereto. Specialized in service training has also been made a requirement. Residence life and extracurricular activities. The new school was built to accommodate 50 children. During the years when overseas students attended, the building was almost always full. With the decline in overseas attendance, the numbers dropped sharply for a while. Mr. Errol Pilgrim, the second principal, brought about a change in the residence requirements when he moved off premises. This resulted in a greater degree of joint management between the chief house mother and the principal, a situation which still exists. The boys enjoyed some good years of scouting with Messrs. Henry Johnson and Errol Pilgrim, two resident teachers who were keen on scouting. Under Mr. Pilgrim's guidance and supervision, their scout troop enjoyed some successful camping trips and participated in some national competitions. The students are still involved in the scout movement under the guidance of Mr. Rudolph Papernet, who is in charge of the 2nd Santa Cruz Cub Scout Pack. They made a trip to Tobago and enjoyed several days of camping with some of their sighted colleagues. There was also a girl guide group and brownies started by Mrs. Rita Knox and subsequently carried on by an assistant house mother. The group is now being run by a volunteer guide mistress and is doing quite well. In addition to the house system, the teaching staff introduced other activities in an effort to explore and develop the interest of the students. The most outstanding of these was the Senior Literary Club, which was formed in 1954 under Mr. John Knox's guidance. The standard of debates and speeches varied with the change of students, but it became a kind of prestige club, one that the juniors looked forward to joining. Another interesting activity which resulted from a conversation I had with Mr. Blackman, one of the teachers, was Good English Week. During that week we highlighted some aspects of language in various ways. There were reading competitions, a talk on some aspects of language, spelling competitions, and a sentence correcting competition. I think the sentence correcting was the most humorous part of the week. The preparation and execution of this project was a joint effort by all the teachers, and the students enjoyed it immensely. The success was so encouraging that we invited the Santa Cruz RC School to join us one year. The students accepted the challenge and gave a very good account of themselves. Swimming became a very important part of the recreation and physical education program when the Junior Chamber of Commerce constructed a pool on the premises around 1961. Mrs. Rowland Hunt, the wife of one of the British High Commissioners, and some members of the UK Women's Club, gave swimming lessons to the students for several years. Unfortunately, the club was unable to continue this program, but alternative arrangements were made for it to be carried on. Over time, however, as a result of inadequate maintenance, the pool has fallen into a state of disrepair and up to the time of writing the swimming program has been suspended. Integration, It was only some 12 to 13 years after the opening of the new school when integration began. After some serious teething problems, three students were allowed to complete their primary education at the San Juan Presbyterian School. In 1967, these students gained entry into secondary schools. Cecilia Ramza Waxing and Donna Jordan attended St. Joseph's Convent, Port of Spain, and Trevor Small went to Trinity College. Writing, the Common Entrance Test was introduced several years later. It was truly heartwarming to witness the excitement and enthusiasm among the staff as we began this new venture. The principals and teachers of the schools concerned were also very keen in helping to solve any problems that might arise. Some members of the Santa Cruz school staff remained after hours to help the students with their homework in the new subject areas of foreign languages and science. Mathematics had its special problems. An enormous debt of gratitude is owed to the many volunteers without whom integration could not have succeeded. Outstanding among those in the early days were Mrs. Anne Hilton and some members of the UK Women's Club, who recorded textbooks and helped with the dictation of lessons to be brailled. The club also assisted by providing many tapes and tape recorders for the students. In 1972, Cecilia, Donna and Trevor became the first students from the School for the Blind to write the GCEO level examinations. What an exciting time that was! The GCE syndicate said that the questions would be sent in Braille, but arrangements would have to be made locally for the transcription of the answers into print. A dictationist and a typist were on standby for each student, and at the end of each examination a true reproduction of the student's work was put into print and forwarded to the syndicate via the Ministry of Education. That method of operation has been carried on through the years, except when a student has been able to type his/her own work. As time went by, students attended other schools such as Fatima College, Queen's Royal College, St. Mary's College and Bishop Anstey High School. Special mention must be made of St. Dominic's Convent. The principal accepted a number of our girls over the years, including two who wanted to repeat some of the GCEO level subjects. It was from this school, also, that our first professional went on to Mosica Teachers College. Mrs. Claudette Papinet received her certificate in 1979 and is making an invaluable contribution at the school in Santa Cruz. Our first from the University of the West Indies was also a student from St. Dominic's. Maureen Ramroop received her BSc degree from the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine, in 1992. The first university graduate, however, was Donna Jordan, one of three who wrote the GCE examinations in 1972. She obtained her BCom degree from Concordia University in 1977, and 4 years later, working part-time, she received her MBA from McGill. Within recent years, the number of children being mainstreamed from the school at Santa Cruz has increased, thereby placing a great burden in the staff and stretching the available facilities. In an education policy paper, prepared by a National Task Force on Education, mainstreaming of special children is recommended, except for severe cases. Plans for implementation are discussed in some detail. The establishment of diagnostic prescriptive centers, greater family involvement and public education programs. Implementation of these ideas will certainly take some time. These are indeed excellent plans, and the special education unit within the ministry should be the body responsible for preparing and coordinating such programs for special children. The unit would be able to draw on the wealth of knowledge and experience acquired by personnel directly involved in the work when developing and implementing the ideas contained in the policy paper. A more proactive role by the association would be of great assistance, especially in the area of family contact and public education programs. It must be admitted, however, that this kind of education is very expensive, and it is necessary, therefore, to seek regional and international cooperation with organizations such as the Caribbean Council for the Blind and other agencies in the developed countries if any real success is to be achieved. Underpinning all these efforts must be the commitment and dedication by our teachers, associations and families, which will help the students acquire that self-esteem and self-confidence they will need in order to meet and overcome the challenges they will encounter during and after school life. About Maurice Connor, see page 85. An assortment of handicraft products made at the TTBWA, from baskets to bassinets.